From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. People often tell film director Andrew Davis that their fingers go numb when they watch one of his movies from gripping their seats so hard. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the director of the action films Under Siege, Code of Silence, and The Fugitive. Also, Pulitzer Prize-winning sports writer and columnist Jim Murray. He's best known for his ability to capture the essence of an athlete in a few short words. He wrote of Muhammad Ali, he didn't have fights, he gave recitals. Murray has a new memoir. Our rock historian Ed Ward highlights some obscure gems from Motown that have just been reissued. That and more, all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
I'm Frank Stasio, National Public Radio News in Washington. Bosnia's Muslim President Alija Izetbegovic today withdrew his threat to interrupt peace talks in Geneva, but he said no progress has been made on drawing the borders of three future ethnic mini-states in Bosnia. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports from Geneva.
The Bosnian delegation issued a statement today listing eight conditions for the peace talks to succeed, including the implementation of the UN Security Council resolution establishing Sarajevo as a safe area. The list also included the demand that the Bosnian Serbs and Croats give up their claims to areas of Bosnia which had pre-war Muslim majorities. At a press conference later, Izetbegovic, who says he has been under intense pressure to reach a peace settlement based on ethnic partition of Bosnia, said he is not an optimist and didn't expect success very soon. But he appeared unusually relaxed and made clear that he was staying at the talks. Today's session included the Serbian and Croatian presidents, Slobodan Milosevic and Franjo Tudjman. Peace talks mediators had invited the two big power brokers of former Yugoslavia in the hopes that they can put pressure on their Bosnian proxies. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Geneva.
Hezbollah guerrillas killed eight Israeli soldiers and wounded four in two bomb attacks in South Lebanon today. Israeli military officials say Israel retaliated for the first attack by sending warplanes to bomb Hezbollah positions in eastern Lebanon, killing two Hezbollah fighters. The deaths are the first since Israel called off a one-week blitz against South Lebanon last month under a ceasefire arranged by the United States. Israel's envoy to the United Nations charged today that extremists are trying to establish a Muslim fundamentalist empire headed by Iran. The Israeli ambassador said the group is seeking an empire that would stretch from the Indian Ocean to the Pacific. He was commenting on the assassination attempt in Cairo yesterday. Attorney General Janet Reno says she has not decided yet, whether to consolidate the Drug Enforcement Administration into the FBI, but she's also raised the possibility of more consolidations. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
In her weekly meeting with reporters, Attorney General Reno denied a New York Times report that she and the White House have already decided to merge the DEA and FBI, two agencies that both pursue drug cases. She said she would not decide until she reads a report on the history of the agencies, due in 2 weeks. But Reno did say she's long favored a more efficient Justice Department.
For the last 15 years, I've said that I saw duplication, fragmentation, and the failure of federal agencies to work together. I don't know whether merger is the answer or not.
But the DEA and many members of Congress strongly oppose any merger. In her remarks today, Reno also said that consolidating the Customs Service and the Immigration and Naturalization Service into one border control agency is being carefully studied. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 7 points. This is NPR News. The value of the dollar shot up today after the Clinton administration signaled its concern about the currency's fall and the Federal Reserve purchased huge quantities of dollars. The administration's statement marked an abrupt reversal of past U.S. stance of encouraging a lower dollar to promote American exports. The U.S. trade deficit jumped 44% in June to the largest monthly gap in nearly 6 years. The U.S. trade gap with Japan accounted for about a third of the total increase in June. Michigan's governor has signed a law eliminating $6.7 billion in property taxes, the primary funding source for the state's public schools. Right now, it's unclear how the revenue will be replaced. Don Gagne reports.
The new law fulfills a campaign pledge by Governor John Engler to cut Michigan property tax rates. But the hard part comes next. The state legislature must now find a new way to fund schools. Critics like Dolores Smith of the Detroit Public School System say it was irresponsible to cut funding without first guaranteeing where money for public education will come from.
Before you eliminate something as crucial as money going into school to educate our children, which was not enough in the first place, why not have a plan?
Some have suggested a sales tax hike. Sin taxes on alcohol and cigarettes are also a possibility. The governor says he hopes Michigan can come up with a system which can be a model for other states struggling to fund public schools. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Nicaraguan rebels demanding the resignations of two top government officials today took lawmakers, soldiers, and government officials hostage. Military officials say the hostage takers are former right-wing Contra guerrillas who fought against the Sandinistas in the 1980s. Authorities in the Dominican Republic said a strong earthquake shook the nation's capital today. The quake measured 5.8 on the Richter scale. Despite the magnitude, no major injuries or serious damage was reported. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Andrew Davis has earned a reputation as an accomplished director of intelligent action thrillers. He knows how to get your adrenaline going and stimulate your brain cells in one sitting. His hit movies include the Chuck Norris film, Code of Silence, Above the Law and Under Siege with Steven Seagal, The Package with Gene Hackman, and his latest, The Fugitive, which has become the hit movie of the summer. It reworks the 60s TV show of the same name. Once again, Dr. Richard Kimball, played by Harrison Ford, is falsely accused of murdering his wife. He escapes from jail to clear his name and find his wife's real murderer, the one-armed man. And U.S. Marshal Sam Girard, played by Tommy Lee Jones, is in hot pursuit. The TV show, which starred David Janssen as Dr. Kimball, had a cult following of its own when it originally aired. I asked Davis if he had been one of its fans.
Actually not. I mean, it wasn't that I wasn't a fan. It's just that I didn't watch it. So I guess I wasn't a fan. The 60s were very busy for a lot of people. And I was growing up and going to college and finishing high school. And actually Harrison Ford and Tommy Lee Jones and myself really never watched the show much. And I think that may have sort of helped us.
Well, I was wondering whether you had any fears about taking a show, even if you didn't watch it, but that many people did, and it was a picture that was so clear in so many viewers' minds, and a character, Dr. Richard Kimball, certainly is played by David Janssen, that was so clear in people's minds, whether you had any fears about changing that at all.
Well, you know, Harrison is not David Janssen.
No.
And this is going to be a modern movie and not an episodic TV show. So we knew immediately that it had to have a different style. And by looking at a few episodes of the show and the final version of the show, it was clear what the elements were that anybody attached to it would want to see and had to be retained. They were basically very interesting dramatic elements.
Such as?
Well, an unjustly accused man, you know, the justice system failing, the loss of his wife, which was not very embellished and actually not an issue in the TV show, but we felt that it needed to be. Being pursued by a man named, like Girard, who was had this great kind of energy, and the fact that the murder was committed by a unique person, a one-armed man. Those elements were easy to keep.
Why Harrison Ford, and was he your first choice to play Dr. Kimball?
Harrison Ford chose me. So it was the other way around. I had just finished another movie called Under Siege, and I was expecting to take time off. And I got a phone call from Warner Brothers saying that Harrison had seen Under Siege and wanted me to meet with him and to have me direct this movie if the meeting went well. And it did.
What did you like about what he could bring to that character, Dr. Kimball?
Well, he had a great range. First of all, he was a very sophisticated vascular surgeon, which fit perfectly. He's a great everyman. So that people could identify with him in terms of this could happen to me. And the fact that his own movie mystique is such a heroic kind of guy who's in jeopardy was perfect to fit into this role.
Now, Sam Girard, who's the U.S. Marshal who's obsessed with tracking down Dr. Kimball, is played by Tommy Lee Jones. And you seem to have changed this character slightly. He seems to be less malevolent than the TV show. Were you interested in humanizing him?
Yeah, I think everybody was interested in getting rid of cliches. and to have the pursuer have dimension, because he's really not the bad guy.
No.
He's just the heat. He's the pulse. He's the pressure on Richard Kimball. And to give him some range as a human being, and to have people around him like his other marshals who could play off of him and with him, I felt was important.
Well, I don't want to give too much away, although I realize a lot of people have seen The Fugitive already, but there is a scene in the movie. It's a train crash. It crashes into the bus that is transporting Dr. Kimball to prison. And it's a spectacular scene, and my understanding is that it really happened, in that you used a real train and a real train wreck. Why did you want to do that?
Well, why not? I didn't want to animate Harrison Ford, and I didn't want to, you know, not shoot in Chicago. So we wanted to make everything real. There's just no way to duplicate that kind of reality. You can get close and you can trick people. But for the kind of coverage we wanted to have, it would have been very complicated. We, in fact, did do some special effects shots that are part of the sequence, but there was an incredible train crash of a freight train into a bus.
Now, where did you film this scene?
In North Carolina.
And it was the Smoky Mountain Railroad,
right.
Is that right?
Smoky, yes, that's right.
How did you find Dillsboro. How did you find this particular railroad?
Well, actually, we scouted in Illinois first, and we're looking in Missouri and Indiana. I think one of our location scouts found a book about independently owned railways and began getting on the phone. And it turned out there was a dam in North Carolina that we could use for another part of the chase, and a tunnel that all fit together. So it worked out quite well.
So someone called up and said, we want to film a train wreck. Can we use your train?
Well, actually, what we did is we sort of assembled our own train. We bought 7 or 8 different cars that were specifically decided by ourselves that we wanted to have. And we found an old locomotive that we were able to take the engine out of. It was a junker. And we, in fact, pushed one locomotive, and the locomotive that hit the bus was a real one, didn't get hurt at all.
Now, I understand that you had some 11 cameras going. Is that right? And obviously with this, it's one take and one take only.
I think it was closer to over 13 or 16 cameras by the time we put it all together. Yeah, it was one take only. That's correct. We had cranes there if we had to do a second take, but it wasn't necessary.
How much planning went into this particular scene?
Well, once we found the location, I would say about a month and a half. Worth of real work with grading the track and putting in certain trestles of our own and having the ability to have a track hidden under the dirt so the train, in fact, could start chasing Harrison and look like it's chasing Harrison.
Well, certainly most of your movies, and I probably should list them, Under Siege, The Package, Above the Law, Code of Silence, these are all pretty much action movies. What is satisfying about making these kinds of pictures?
Well, you know, I didn't start out to be an action director. I'd done a lot of that work as a cameraman. And I made a musical film, a little musical film called Stony Island, and then was hired to direct a movie by Chuck Norris, a Chuck Norris movie called Code of Silence. And it was successful. And people said, well, he can do that. Let's let him do another one and another one. The satisfying part is that you really get to use your talents as a director. It's very visual. There's a lot of characters, there's a lot of stuff going on, and you get to be a filmmaker. I've been able to get themes into these films that make the difference to me in terms of having some kind of social fabric, whether it be about police brutality or guns and drugs for arms and the end of the Cold War and the military-industrial complex and needing to have it continue. These are all themes that have gone on in films I've done, and I can get away with it because it makes them more real.
Hmm.
And it makes the characters grounded in a reality where you care about them more and the action doesn't seem cartoonish.
Is there an approach you have to filming violence? And I wouldn't say your films are necessarily violent, but there are some violent scenes. I know in Under Siege, the actor, whose name?
Steven Seagal,
thank you. He actually kind of rips the throat out of a guy that he's taking on. And I wonder how you think about and how you approach a scene like that.
Well, actually, working with Steven Seagal and those kinds of scenes, Those are like Oriental kind of, you know, martial arts kind of techniques that he draws out of his background. And basically, I photograph them. I don't tell him how to do it. And that's not stuff that I'm really interested in. I'm much more interested in the movement of the movie and in the characters that are part of the story that fit into what's going on there. I'm not proud of that kind of stuff, and hopefully I won't have to do that kind of work anymore.
You're not proud of it. Why?
Well, I don't think entertainment should be about violence. Mm-hmm. I mean, the violence should not be the entertainment part of a movie. I think heroicism, and I think that the movement and action and tension and chase is all part of what movies have been about from the beginning. As a matter of fact, you know, I remember seeing train crashes at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago when I was a kid to play with a player piano, you know, in the old 1910 street. But I think that that films can be, if there's going to be violence in films, it should not be fluffed up. It shouldn't be cartoonish. Because when people get shot, they die. And I don't think that we should have films that use these kinds of scenes as a way to handle human behavior. It would be better if people could talk things through. But if you're going to depict it, don't pamper it.
I noticed that you've worked a number of times with Tommy Lee Jones and also with Steven Seagal. What do you get as a director when you work with an actor over time in one movie after another?
Well, you get trust and you get great collaboration, which is what I need. I mean, the more people who have good ideas, the better I am as a director, and the better the movie's going to be. And some people don't like that. They don't. They want. They know. They create the script or they've inherited a script. They don't want to change it. They envision it. They just want to have their own vision. And I think I feel comfortable enough about the process that I, you know, sort of set a tone and set a point of view about what the scene is about. And then work with people to try to get them to give me the best they can for it.
I'm speaking with director Andrew Davis. His latest film is The Fugitive. Did you go to the movies a lot as a kid?
Yeah. We used to go to see The Thing, you know, and be in yo-yo contests and stuff like that. And, you know, I remember seeing The Magnificent Seven in Madison, Wisconsin. My sister was in school up there, and some of her friends took me to a movie, and I loved it. I really loved the experience of sitting in the balcony and going off on that ride. And I was influenced by all kinds of movies, but I remember as a kid there was a film called Little Fugitive, which was sort of an Italian realistic movie done in New York, about a kid who is a latchkey kid, and that made a big impression on me.
Why? Yeah.
Oh, because it was about a kid who was left alone. And his brother acted like he had killed him. You know, it was a phony murder taking place, and the young brother thought he had killed his older brother and was left alone under Coney Island wandering around. It was very, for a young kid to be immersed in another kid your age you cared about. And it felt real to me. It was done in Coney Island running around. I remembered later in life that I, in fact, was involved in photography when I was very young at the YMCA, and later was a projectionist in grammar school of movies, and then got into music. So there was a background, a great interest in photography, and through my parents, I was able to meet and work with Haskell Wexler on Medium Cool in 1968, which really opened the doors for me. And Haskell sort of became a role model for me as a young cameraman.
Well, you were an assistant cameraman for him for Medium Cool.
Well, I was an assistant cameraman for him on a phantom unit that was shooting all of the riot footage and being gassed by the police. I wasn't actually on the regular 35mm part of it, but we met and then worked together on a couple scripts.
So you were right in the middle of the riots at the 68 convention?
Mm-hmm. Right where we shot The Fugitive. The roof of the Hilton.
Well, let me ask you something, because one of the people that works for Fresh Air said, ask him, because he was watching Medium Cool, and he said there's one point where some tear gas gets thrown, and you hear on camera someone
Haskell says,
it's real. Is that
you?
Yeah,
no, there wasn't me, but the Chicago accent sounds the same.
How has being a cameraman helped you as a director?
Well, people come to directing from all kinds of points of view. And some are writers, some are actors, some are producers, some are art directors. And I feel coming from the camera is great, because the analogy that I've been using is that, you know, it's like conducting a symphony without being able to read music.
Hmm.
And there are great directors who don't come from this background. Very few actually come from the camera. But some people who, for example, Fellini was a cartoonist. He has a visual orientation. Kubrick was a still photographer. There are certain people who either acquire it, you know, or have it to begin with.
I understand that the movie, at least you finished the movie very quickly, and the editing job had to be done very, very quickly to get it into the theaters in August.
We finished shooting May 18th, and we had to be done editing, absolutely editing every frame of film by the first or second week of June. So it was incredible. It was cut really in about 6 weeks.
Do you like to work fast like that?
Well, this film was unique because it's a film about a chase.
Yeah.
And I think, we were all in a chase the whole time. The script was constantly evolving. We improvised on the set every day. And the pace that the editing had, I think, it lent some energy to the final product.
Well, I thank you very much, Andrew Davis, for joining us today on Fresh Air and talking to us about your movies.
Thank you. It was nice talking to you.
Andrew Davis is the director of The Fugitive.
Your fugitive's name is Dr. Richard Kimball. Go get him.
This is Fresh Air. For a label that had such an impact on American popular music, Motown has never really been perceived as anything except a hit factory. Yet the producers, songwriters, and singers who made those hits also recorded lots of other stuff, some of it just as good as the chartbusters for which Motown is remembered today. Our rock and roll historian Ed Ward will play some of this music for us and has a plea to let more of it come out.
Since you've been
since I've been doing these pieces, one of the most frequently made requests listeners have is, do something on Motown. But what, is my reply. What, after all the books and documentaries and endless reissues of the hits, would be fresh and interesting? Since the film The Big Chill slammed Motown's music back into our consciousness, it suffered one of the worst cases of pop overexposure I've ever seen. But earlier this year, accompanied by zero publicity, Rhino Records put out 4 CDs that started me thinking. Labeled More of the Best, they featured the Four Tops, Marvin Gaye, the Temptations, and Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. Comprised of album tracks and singles that never made it onto albums, they're chock full of surprises.
By the look in your eye, I can tell you're gonna cry. Is it over me? If it is, save your tears, for I'm not worth it, you see.
Some of these songs, like Marvin Gaye's Wherever I Lay My Hat, I'd always assumed were singles, probably because I knew them from somebody else's version or from a tape somebody I knew had compiled. Others, though, were complete surprises. Miracles recorded More, More, More of Your Love on the Away We A Go-Go album, along with a lovely ballad called Swept For You Baby and Smokey's own version of the hit he wrote for the Temptations, Beauty's Only Skin Deep. Of course, in 1967, nobody I knew would purchase something entitled Away We A Go-Go, even if it was Smokey and the Miracles, so we missed it. And that's the clue to why these discs are so great. Motown never featured itself as an album label until Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder started to get conceptual in the 70s. Too often, the albums were filled with horrible show tunes and flat readings of other people's songs, so that gems went unheard. Case in point. Anybody who ever bought a Temptations album, except for The Temptations Sing Smokey and Greatest Hits, and I don't think I've ever seen a copy of With a Lot O' Soul, the album Ain't No Sun Since You've Been Gone is from. But again, there are a couple of prime tracks from it on this disc. Of course, I've suspected this for some time, mainly because I spent years looking for a copy of Martha and the Vandellas Dance Party album so I could astonish people with this.
Hey, everybody.
Motoring was the B-side of Dancing in the Street, a perfect example of how Motown wasted classics by slapping them on the back of other classics. Another example.
Yeah.
B-side of Since I Lost My Baby, but it should have been a hit all on its own. The 72 tracks on these four collections only scratch the surface. What about lesser-known Motown acts like Martha and the Vandellas, or the Marvelettes, or the late Marv Johnson, or out-and-out obscurities like the Spinners, Mabel John, Brenda Holloway, the Satin Tones, Carolyn Crawford, and Herman Griffin? Motown has yet to allow an archivist to compile collections of unsuccessful or little-known records from their vaults. But what little I've heard makes me think it might well be the only cure for Motown burnout. Come on, Motown, let Rhino or somebody do Unknown Motown, Volumes 1 to 5. You might be surprised at the response.
Ed Ward is organizing a music conference and sampling bratwurst in Berlin for the next few months. I'm Marty Moskowain. This is Fresh Air.
Every day I walk some lonely street.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. Pulitzer Prize-winning sports writer Jim Murray is best known for his vivid descriptions of legendary sports figures like Muhammad Ali, Arnold Palmer, and Pete Rose. He began his career writing gossip about Hollywood stars. Now he's taken on the task of writing about himself. Coming up, we talk with Jim Murray about his new autobiography. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new Woody Allen comedy that teams him up again with Diane Keaton, Manhattan Murder Mystery. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Los Angeles, the prosecution delivered its opening statements in the trial today of two young black men accused in the beating of a white truck driver during last year's riots. Though this racially charged case is best known for its main victim, Reginald Denny, the prosecution emphasized that there were seven other people involved. NPR's Renee Montaigne reports from the Los Angeles County Criminal Courthouse.
In opening statements, the prosecution made it clear that it will rely heavily on the many photographs and videotapes taken on the late afternoon of April 29, 1992, at the intersection of Florence and Normandy in South Central Los Angeles to prove that defendants Damian Williams and Henry Watson intended to murder Reginald Denny. Dimming the lights, the prosecutor showed a chilling series of scenes, a man prosecutors identified as Damian Williams holding a brick and Denny drenched in blood. In his opening statements, Williams' defense lawyer said evidence will show that the videotape, stills, and photographs are unreliable in identifying his client, and he said the chaotic scene itself shows that no one planned or premeditated any of the crimes. At the Los Angeles County Criminal Courthouse, I'm Renee Montaigne.
Labor Secretary Robert Reich wants to boost the minimum wage and is encouraging President Clinton to increase the current $4.25 an hour by 25 cents. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
In a memo to the president, the labor secretary suggests raising the standard by a quarter, but also indexing the wage to inflation so that it would automatically increase each year. The memo was leaked by the Employment Policies Institute, which opposes any increase or indexing. The institute is largely financed by the food service industry and argues that raising the wage will reduce employment for low-skilled workers. In the memo, Reich says the increase is a minimum prerequisite to reaching the goal of lifting families of four with full-time workers out of poverty. Congress last raised the wage in 1990, but Reich argues that increase made up less than half the amount that had already been lost to inflation. Reich has the support of at least one member of Congress. Independent House member Bernie Sanders of Vermont has tirelessly demanded an increase since taking office. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
In Somalia, gunmen attacked a military truck carrying four U.S. soldiers, but the soldiers received only minor injuries. The attack followed a remote-controlled mine explosion that lifted the truck into the air, but the Americans were able to fire back and drive their truck away. The explosion broke a lull in the fighting of almost 1 week and was the second time in 2 weeks that a U.S. Army vehicle was hit by a remote-controlled mine. In the first attack, four Americans were killed. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 7 points to close at 3,612.13, a new high on volume of more than 293 million shares. This is NPR News. In Geneva, warring factional leaders from Bosnia have been unable to decide on borders for dividing their nation into three separate states. After 5 hours of talks, a spokesman said that no progress had been made. According to reports, UN mediator David Owen is pressing the various factions to make compromises on borders. A conference spokesman said that talks are centered on five areas where Bosnian Muslims are battling either Serbian or Croatian factions. So far this week, negotiators have agreed to allow Sarajevo to be under UN control after a peace agreement is reached. A federal commission chartered to help revive the nation's troubled airline industry has issued its final report. And the commission recommended a host of tax breaks and the easing of some costly government regulations. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
The commission was appointed 3 months ago by Congress and President Clinton, who, during the campaign, promised to do what he could to help revive the nation's airline and aerospace industries. But today, in issuing its final report, the commission suggested fairly mild government remedies. Most of its recommendations focused on tax breaks for the industry, including a 2-year exemption from the higher gasoline tax, as well as reducing ticket and cargo taxes. The commission also recommended that the government allow greater foreign ownership of U.S. airlines, provided that equal opportunities exist overseas. The commission stopped short of recommending government re-regulation of fares and routes, although it did call for the formation of a government oversight board to monitor the industry's financial status. This is Eric Weiner in Washington.
According to various news reports from Moscow, Russian President Boris Yeltsin has vetoed a law passed by the Russian parliament that would have excluded foreign banks from the Russian market. The law was approved last month over the opposition of the Russian Central Bank and would have hindered 4 foreign banks that already have licenses to operate in Russia. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Sports columnist Jim Murray gives sound bites a good name. Here are a few quotes from some of his columns. On ballplayer Ricky Henderson, he has a strike zone the size of Hitler's heart. On the Twin Cities, they didn't like each other, and from what I see, I didn't blame either. On former NFL quarterback and coach Norm Van Brocklin, a guy with the nice, even disposition of a top sergeant whose shoes are too tight. Jim Murray has been a journalist for 50 years, first as a general assignment reporter, then as a movie correspondent, and finally as a sports columnist. Over the years, he has endeared himself to players and other writers alike who respect him for his incisive writing and his humane approach to covering sports. Murray has been writing about sports for the Los Angeles Times since 1961. He has received the National Sports Writer of the Year Award 14 times. He's been a member of the Writers' Wing of Baseball's Hall of Fame and most recently received the Pulitzer Prize. He's just written a memoir called simply Jim Murray. Murray told me he started writing plays as a young boy. He even dreamed of becoming another Eugene O'Neill. The closest he got was covering Hollywood for Time magazine. I asked him if he found movie stars interesting people to write about.
Oh, Lord, yes. They're different from most of us. Oh, sure. They live in a fantasy world, really. And they're some of them are, if you talk about the split personality or the three faces of Eve or whatever. Actors and actresses, they have 20 personalities. You know, they fit the occasion or the drama with the appropriate personality. Yeah, they were fascinating to write about.
And a challenge, I would think, for a journalist.
Yes, in a way they were, except, of course, they're people. And I basically did cover stories. That was my main job. I sent in what is known as a cinema letter, which is a weekly compendium of gossip and what's going on in the industry and who's doing what to whom, and occasionally an inside takeout. But basically, the magazine wanted female movie stars, or love goddesses, as life called them, to break up the monotony of generals and secretaries of state and all these dour visages on the cover, which wouldn't sell anything on the newsstand. And they wanted to put a pretty girl on to beef up the newsstand sales periodically. I know that sounds cynical, but they also wanted to cover Hollywood because they knew that the public was interested in reading about it. But that was really my main job, was to develop cover stories.
Would you describe for us your dinner with Marilyn Monroe?
Yes. We were sort of grooming Marilyn to be a cover personality, and I was assigned to do what was known as a takeout on her, which was usually a full-page story in the middle of the magazine. So it seemed the simplest way to do that was to go to dinner, and we went to a place, I think it was called the Villa Nova, up on the Sunset Strip. It was run by a man named Alan Dale. And I picked up Marilyn at her hotel down in the Carlton or something like that, down on the Olympic Boulevard. And we went to the restaurant. In the middle of our dinner and interview, I saw this very familiar, famous figure walking in. And the owner immediately scurried around and escorted him to a table and put a screen around the table. Well, the gossip columns had been alluding to Marilyn's romance with this man. So at the end of the dinner, maybe 10, 11 o'clock at night, Marilyn leans over and puts her hand on my arm and says, would you mind terribly if you didn't take me home and a friend of mine did? And I said, not at all, Marilyn, if you'll introduce me to Joe DiMaggio.
And did she?
Oh, she did, and I was thrilled to death. Marilyn was not a big star then, but she was beginning to be.
You have a line about her, and you write, she was as insecure about her appearance as Quasimodo.
Well, you remember my alluding to picking her up in the hotel on Olympic Boulevard. What you did with Marilyn, if dinner was for 7, you told her 6. If the dinner was for 8:30, you told her 7. And that way you had a fighting chance for her to be ready, at the real hour. Because I think she would start to get dressed and change dresses and change hairdos and all the rest of it. She was notorious for that. I wasn't the only one that was victimized by that. Other colleagues who had picture shoots with her from Life magazine and so forth were always knew they would have to stand on one foot and wait for two and a half hours. Marilyn was very insecure about herself and her appearance.
A line like that, which I think is a fabulous sentence, is that something that comes to you or something that you had to struggle over?
Marty, it used to come. I would start to write, and I would picture myself when I came to the appropriate place in the writing. I picture to myself reaching up with my thumb and forefinger and jerking the appropriate word down and slipping it into the column. And I relied on that. I knew it would come because it was in there someplace. As I get older, sometimes I reach up and grab, and I have to turn around and look. It isn't there, you know. But in those days, yes, it was pretty much there. Writing is a little bit like golf or tennis. You get into a rhythm, and sometimes you're surprised yourself afterwards. But they're there.
Well, I want to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest today is Jim Murray, and of course the well-known sports columnist Jim Murray. He's written a book about his life as a journalist, and it's called Jim Murray. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is sports columnist Jim Murray. You went from writing about Hollywood stars and starlets to writing about sports and sports figures. Did you or do you approach athletes the way you would someone like Marilyn Monroe or Humphrey Bogart or Cary Grant or any of the other famous stars you interviewed?
Oh, yes. As I've said in the book, I've always written about people. I never write about. I can cover the Indianapolis 500 and never mention a car, but I'll mention drivers because they're interesting people, and people are people, and particularly they're almost the same kind of people. They're both they're both in show business really, and they're public figures, and public figures behave in a certain way that the guy that drives a truck doesn't behave, and they also tend to behave colorfully. I don't think there was any difference in writing whether you wrote about Humphrey Bogart or Sandy Koufax.
Why do you think so many writers, and including sports writers and other kinds of writers, become so lyrical when it comes to baseball? What is it about baseball that brings that out in writers?
Well, I think baseball is the ultimate heirloom sport. It's handed down from father to son more than any other sport, I believe. It's become almost like, I hate to say a religious experience. It sounds ridiculous, but it's a comfortable sport. It's a contemplative sport. It's kind of slow moving, and it's just comfortable, and it's the national pastime. And I think that when you look up to your parents or your uncles in my case, and they take it seriously, you tend to take it seriously. And I think that baseball, you know, has a very special place in the national psyche, which other sports are tending to try to dislodge and are making some inroads because, you know, the new generation is probably wants something faster and more violent than baseball.
You write that baseball players are a sports writer's delight. Why is that?
I think there's the highest percentage of eccentrics in baseball than any other sport. For one reason, baseball players until very recently never went to college. I mean, the scouts would not let them. They didn't want them to go waste 4 years. They wanted them to go to Durham and become a player. Whereas the other sports, you really have to go to college. You can't become a basketball player or a pro football player unless you first go into college. Even a golfer in some other sports. So you tend at least to have a veneer of education and maybe sophistication. Whereas while there are sophisticated, mature, and very well-educated baseball players, there's really an awful lot of the other kind of real American eccentrics, and they do eerie things, which make very good copy.
You seem to have a fondness for Pete Rose.
I like Pete Rose. Pete Rose was, as I said in the book, Pete Rose always looked to me like a kid who was coming downstairs on Christmas morning and expecting to find a pony under the tree. He loved baseball. I never came away. Anytime I needed a column, I could go to Pete Rose, Casey Stengel, and today Tommy Lasorda, because they loved what they did. They loved to talk about it. And they talked colorfully about it. Pete would spend a half an hour showing you how to do a head first slide into second base. He knew every hit he ever made, knew where it put him in the standings, lifetime standings. I mean, you know, all kinds of obscure things like how many doubles he got off left-handed pitches with Italian names and anything you wanted. Pete knew it.
You say he wasn't as talented as some of the other famous players, but as you wrote about him, I got the feeling he had this kind of underachiever's passion for the game.
He had a passion for the game. Pete was obviously a good hitter. I mean, my word, 4,200 hits. But I don't think he had the native ability of a Willie Mays, for example. He certainly couldn't run as fast. He certainly didn't have the raw power. I mean, Willie Mays could hit you a single or a home run with equal skill and enthusiasm, Roberto Henry Aaron or Roberto Clemente. Roberto Clemente might have been as good as any player who ever played the game. I think he was a very underrated player. And these guys sort of rolled out of bed with their ability to hit a curving ball or whatever. I think Pete had to work on it. In fact, my all-time favorite player was a relatively unknown player named Jim Gilliam, who really did not have any of these skills except decent speed. But he made himself into a fine, fine baseball player. And I think Pete Rose made himself into the greatest hitter that ever lived by sheer will and determination.
I'm speaking with sports columnist Jim Murray, and he's just written a book about himself, simply called Jim Murray. How would you say television is changing sports writing?
Well, television is changing sports writing by ladling millions and millions of dollars on these athletes so that they don't really feel they need us anymore. As I've often said, athletes in 40 years ago made $40,000 a year. They knew that when they quit, they would probably want to open a hardware store or a bowling alley or a saloon or whatever, and the publicity would be good, you know. Mickey Mantle's 17 lanes or whatever. So they would, they would sort of accommodate us because they wanted, maybe even sought the publicity. Well, a ballplayer making $7 million doesn't think, plus shoe contracts, doesn't think he's ever going to need any money. And what does he need you for? You're just a nuisance.
So does that mean it's really, even after all of your years, that it's harder and harder to get an interview with a sports person?
I think that there has grown up an adversarial relationship that was always a little bit present, but I think it's gotten gotten much more pronounced today. That you just have to look at the difficulties of the Mets this year, and you can see that firecrackers were originally thrown at sports writers in that by that franchise, and Yeah, I just think that there's much more of an adversary relationship than there was 40 years ago.
And I wonder, too, whether the quality of writing you think is being changed by television.
No. If it is, it's changing for the better because, again, 40, 45 years ago, all you had to do was go to the ballpark and write a game story, which, you know, you can write standing on your head, you know. His bat flashing in the lights, comma, Babe Ruth yesterday hit a grand slam to defeat the Chicago White Sox 7-4, period, paragraph. The winning pitcher was Joe Fobb, the loser. You know, you can, that's nothing. Then you put your typewriter away and get downstairs and have a drink and go home. Now, if you're covering a World Series or whatever, the public doesn't buy the paper to get the game story. They've already seen it. They've seen it in an instant replay. They've seen it over and over. They know everything that happened in the game. So you have to get an angle. You have to get some additional set of facts or a different angle in the game, and that's a lot more difficult than writing a game story.
You've written, Gentlemen, Start Your Coffins. Does that pretty much sum up your attitude towards auto racing?
That, I think, was written the year after the driver who was probably the nicest to me in the early days, Eddie Sachs, was killed in probably the worst accident in the Speedway history, where he and a rookie driver, it was the first time the race had ever been stopped for anything. And I think that it was right after that that I wrote that sentence, which didn't endear me to the auto racing establishment. But since that time, strangely enough, the cars go faster, but they go safer. There are accidents, but there are fewer fatal accidents. In those days, one out of every three drivers who got in a race car died in a race car.
One out of three.
Up until the early 60s, that was an absolutely valid statistic. And that's no longer true.
So do you think you'll ever retire?
Not next week.
Yeah.
But,
think about retirement?
I hope so. I hope so. I hope I don't die in a Holiday Inn someplace.
Well, I thank you, Jim Murray, very much for joining us.
Okay, Murray.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Sports columnist Jim Murray. His memoir is called aptly, Jim Murray. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Let me tell you about some of the stories they'll be covering today. First, the new trial in Los Angeles of the young man accused of beating the truck driver Reginald Denny, which happened during the L.A. riots. Also, there'll be a story about the bombing of South Lebanon by Israel in response to terrorist activities yesterday. There'll be an update on the Tailhook scandal, also an update on the relationship between the dollar and the yen. The President's Commission on the Airlines released a report today. They'll cover that story. And, of course, the Thursday feature, Letters from Listeners. All those stories later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. At the height of the big scandal about his relationship with Mia Farrow and her children, Woody Allen crept off and made a movie called Manhattan Murder Mystery. Since then, his life hasn't exactly been a barrel of laughs. Film critic Stephen Schiff went to see whether his movie is.
Well, not a barrel, more like a grocery bag. Maybe Woody Allen decided that this wasn't exactly the time to present himself as a moral everyman exploring life's imponderables. Maybe he thought this wasn't precisely the moment to defy those fans who just wish he'd quit moaning and groaning and return to the kind of simple comedy that made him famous back in the 70s. Whatever the reason, Woody has produced a tiny, mild, pleasurable little spoof that casts him in the sort of role he hasn't played for a long time. The helpless nebbish, someone who instantly makes you forget that Allen may have victimized women and children because he doesn't seem capable of forcing his will on a shoelace. Allen plays Larry Lipton, a book editor who's been married for so long to his wife, Carol, played by Diane Keaton, that they can't quite remember what's keeping them together. The oomph is gone. Then one night, they're invited for coffee at their neighbor's, Mr. and Mrs. House, a couple of first-class bores who seem a lot less boring the next day when Mrs. House turns up dead, apparently of a coronary. I say apparently because Mr. House doesn't seem all that troubled by her departure. And this and a couple of other fishy odds and ends make Carol decide that Mr. House has done Mrs. House in. All of which strikes Larry as not only preposterous, but pretty scary. And above all, exasperating. Especially when Carol insists on leaping out of bed at 2 in the morning to sneak into Mr. House's apartment.
Hey, listen to me. Come here.
What are you talking
about?
Come
here. Wait a minute.
Come here.
Look,
what do you mean,
Larry? Look, I've been thinking about you.
What do you
think
mean?
You got to see you. You got to go back to your shrink. I want you to see Dr. Ballard again.
Larry, I went for 2 years.
Yeah, I know.
Just
but you,
come,
you know how General Motors will recall defective cars? You got to go in for a tune-up.
You'll be in and out in 5 minutes.
No. I'm telling you, I'm your husband. I command you to sleep.
I command it. Larry,
sleep.
All I can tell you is if this had been a few years ago, you would have been doing the same thing. Because if you recall, we solved the mystery. Yep, we solved the mystery once. Remember? It was the noises in the attic mystery.
The country house, the bluebird.
That's right.
But that was a sweet mystery. This is murder.
You agree, right?
No, it's murder, Larry.
Look,
no, murder. I forbid you. I forbid you to go. I'm forbidding. Is that what you do when I forbid you?
You can see that what works in this movie is the comic banter. Alan and Keaton have such fizzy chemistry that even their flattest lines can give you a tickle, which is a lucky thing. Because this movie doesn't have much else going for it. The suspense plot does develop, but never enough to feel suspenseful. And the climax, thick with movie quotes, is one of the clumsiest scenes Alan has ever staged. Worse, he's still devoted to the kind of jerky handheld camera work that made Pepto-Bismol such a vital adjunct to his last movie, Husbands and Wives. The addition of Alan Alda as a playwright in love with Carol and Angelica Houston as a man-eating novelist hungry for Larry doesn't help much. But when the four of them are together plotting their next ploy, Alan can work up a stew of jokes and character touches that makes you remember how intoxicating his great comedies of the 70s could be. In Manhattan Murder Mystery, the thrill of crime-busting rejuvenates Larry and Carol's marriage. The real mystery, of course, is whether this movie can rejuvenate Woody Allen 1 year after he so spectacularly murdered his own career.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Joan Tuohy, Nancy Greenlees, and Beatrice Black. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscowane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the architect of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell compromise on gays in the military. We talk with military sociologist Charles Moscos. Moscos was also the inspiration behind Clinton's National Service Program. I'm Marty Moscowane, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.